Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene! Gene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday. The vault is open, and it is going to be part two of a two-part vault series. Now, last Saturday, we ran part one of our Science of Dune episodes from 2015. We ran the Science of Dune technology. Today, it's going to be another foray into the planet Arrakis. Part two, the Science of Dune biology, which originally aired on October 1st, 2015.
Yeah, there is a lot of sandworm talk in this episode as we sort of piece together the science that that Frank Herbert used to create the idea of the sandworm, as well as scientific interpretations by a couple of different commentators in the decades to follow.
Now, wait a minute, Robert. We're going to be getting another Dune film, right?
Yes.
Is it true by Denis Villeneuve?
Yes, the director of course, the most recent Blade Runner film.
Blade Runner 2049.
Yeah, which I really enjoyed, and it certainly is just full of visual flair, like watching that, and I especially enjoyed the slow pace of the film. Like,
yeah.
Like Blade Runner 2049 is what, 3-4 hours long?
It's about 7 hours long.
Yeah.
But
it feels like it's just an hour and a half.
Yeah.
It feels far shorter than any superhero movie I have ever seen.
How long was Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice? Was that about 6.5 hours?
I don't know. I only saw that over other people's shoulders on an airplane.
I watched it on a flight and could not finish it on the flight. Like, I started it at takeoff and we landed and the movie wasn't over.
Yeah. I don't know. Superhero movies are not necessarily my thing these days. Unless,
no.
Unless it has Wesley Snipes in it. And he's hunting vampires. So, yeah, I am all in on another cinematic vision of Dune. I mean, every element, all the elements we talk about here, the sandworms, if we get to face dancers, I really want to see a nice cinematic vision of the face dancers as well.
I think I might have said this in the original episode, so apologies if I repeat later in our rerun what I'm about to say now. But I think there should be an HBO series adaptation of the Dune universe.
Oh, yeah.
I think what HBO did with Game of Thrones, they should do with Dune.
Yeah, there's plenty of material there. Even in just the first book, you could do a full-blown, drawn-out, cinematic treatment of the thing. I'm currently watching the Netflix adaptation of Richard K. Morgan's Altered Carbon.
Oh, yeah?
Which is a not that lengthy of a novel, but it has a lot of ins and outs, and they've done a really great job of giving it the multi-episode treatment, whereas I like watching their treatment of it, I can't imagine crushing it all down into even a lengthy film. Mm-hmm. So Dune is perfect for that sort of treatment. But I guess we're getting another movie. Hopefully it'll be 4 to 5 hours long. That's what I'm looking for.
100% agree. And I hope it has a little intermission break in it.
Oh.
It just runs for 30 seconds or so.
But not a werewolf break. Because there are no werewolves in Dune.
That's a callback, folks.
All right. Well, without further ado, let's enter the vault.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Disembarkation, disembarkation. Notice to all passengers arriving on Station Arrakis. The Dune Planetary Tourism Consortium, funded by the great generosity of the most noble House Harkonnen, would like to welcome you to planet Arrakis. Arrakis is a dry place. Please remember to conserve water whenever possible. It is recommended that you do not venture outside without a properly fitted stillsuit to recycle your sweat, urine, and fecal moisture. When traveling beyond the shield wall, remember always to watch for worm sign by keeping in mind the three H's: hissing, heaving, and high energy discharge. The hissing sound in the sand, heaving up of displaced sediment, and high energy static discharge from the dunes may all indicate that a sandworm is near. In the event of worm sign, do not activate shields and proceed immediately to the nearest cave, building, or evacuation ornithopter. Local vendors and kiosks found throughout Station Arrakis are the best place to purchase stillsuits, friend kits, and individually packaged worm thumpers at duty-free prices. Please remember also, the spice must flow. Anyone suspected of sabotaging, inhibiting, or interfering with spice production may be subject to penalties, up to and including gladiatorial remuneration on gaining prime or personal evaporation. Please enjoy your stay among the dunes.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And this is episode 2 in our exploration of the science of Dune, the science of Frank Herbert's 1965 sci-fi classic, Dune, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year.
Yeah, so if you missed the first part, you should go back and listen to that first part one, where we talk about the technology of Dune, and we talk about some important sort of introductory materials to the universe of Dune. If you're not familiar with it, we highly recommend that you check out that part first before you listen to this one. But if you just want to get thrown right into the middle, here we are.
Yeah. Last time we talked about Butlerian Jihad, we talked about still suits, we talked about ornithopters, and a little bit about the Holtzman effect.
Whatever that is.
Yeah.
But yeah, this time we're going to talk more about the living science of Dune, about the biology and ecology of the planet Arrakis. And one of the coolest things about the Dune universe has got to be the sandworms.
Yes, I imagine that is one of, if not the key aspects of the franchise that come to people's minds when they think of Dune.
Yeah, I just finished reading this book a few weeks ago, and I loved it. I absolutely adored this book. As I said in the last podcast, it frequently struck me as just amazingly fresh for a 50-year-old book. It's full of ideas that you don't encounter elsewhere. It just felt very original and unique and different. But the moment where the book really kicked into gear for me was the first sandworm attack.
Oh, and this is when they're going out to observe spice harvests, correct?
Yeah. So I want to kind of put the listener into the moment of the sandworm attack. So imagine you're one of a group of 26 spice miners working on a patch of spice in the deep desert. So you're out there among the dunes, the heat is high, the sun's bearing down on you, you've got your protective still suit on, you're working the harvester machine, trying desperately to get this spice going, and you've been at it for several minutes, and overhead there's this enormous cargo aircraft. I suppose it would be some type of ornithopter with flapping wings, which, as we discussed in the last episode, doesn't make a lot of aerodynamic sense, but okay. And it's called a carry-all. It hovers nearby, waiting to lift you off at a moment's notice. and preferably at the last possible minute to maximize the profits, because you've got to get as much spice as you can. The spice is important. The spice must flow. The universe needs it. But a worm will come. The worm always comes. It hears the harvester. It knows where you are. And the moment you start working, it's on its way. Now, with proper precautions, you'll lift off at just the right moment. You'll get the maximum spice and you'll avoid the worm. But if you're not able to lift off in time, you may notice a hissing sound in the sand, sliding, you know, it's sand sliding against sand in the background. You might see a static discharge in the air. And eventually you're going to notice an upheaval of sand as the worm rises to the shallows of the desert. And then finally you see, and it's probably the last thing you see, a great gaping circular mouth, maybe up to 80 meters wide, emerging from the dunes, spreading open, closing over you, and swallowing you and your friends and your mining vehicle all in one bite.
It's quite a sight. And as far as sound goes, we do want to give a quick thanks to Chris Knife 007. He's on Bandcamp as Cheesy Nervosa. We'll include a link to his account on the landing page for this episode. But he does a lot of cool ambient tracks where he gets the ambience from various sci-fi properties. And mm-hmm. So this was the track that we used here was Dune Sandworm Ride.
Yeah, so I love the sandworms. I love the sandworm scenes in the book. When we first encounter sandworms in the book, they're merely as a threat. You know, this huge, terrifying beast that lives in the desert. It's, you know, it's a gigantic snake, eel, worm type creature that is sort of like the monsters in Tremors. You know, it lives under
the graboids.
Yeah. It lives under the ground. It can hear where you are. You know, it might be hundreds of meters long. They're so huge. You can't fight them off. There's no way to avoid them except to run.
Yeah, and I've seen it described that Frank Herbert's sandworms are kind of like dragons, but not merely in just the threat aspect, not just a monstrous dragon, but a celestial dragon, because they're ultimately the gateway to wisdom.
Yeah, that's true, because I don't want to spoil too much, but then later on in the book, we learn that the desert dwellers of the planet Arrakis, the Fremen, have a more complex relationship with the sandworms. It's not just, you know, here's this huge threatening creature that we have to avoid. They have a bit of a back and forth.
Yeah.
I don't want to say too much more, but it's really interesting. And so I thought we should talk about the sandworm. What is this organism as it's imagined in the Dune universe, and how has this changed the way we think about aliens in science fiction, and what analogies can we make to real world life forms?
Yeah. And for starters, let's just go ahead and roll through what we know from Frank Herbert's books. And again, it's one of those cases where Herbert throws a lot of information at you about how sandworms work.
But then when you add it all up.
Right. You realize you don't know key things. Here's what we know. The sandworm, or Shai-Hulud, I believe that is the
yeah.
Fremen term. A creature, again, utterly unique to Arrakis, totally tied to a complex life cycle on the desert planet. Lengths exceed 400 meters, widths of 100 meters at the thickest point, perhaps as long as 1,000 meters in the deep, isolated parts of the desert. Mouth diameter is probably about 80 meters when it's open, and lined with 1,000 or more carbosilica crystal teeth. A typical worm consists of 100 to 400 segments, and each segment possesses its own nervous system.
Oh.
That's something to keep in mind for later. Now, what Herbert didn't tell us, he didn't tell us whether sandworms lay eggs. He didn't tell us if they're male and female, how reproduction occurs at all. He didn't tell us if it's definitively if it's a vertebrate or an invertebrate. He didn't explain the physics of how it moves, and he didn't tell us what it eats.
I would be surprised if it's vertebrate, simply because I think of vertebrate as a category belonging to Earth life. I mean, I think
yeah.
it might have some kind of internal, you know, rigid structure, but it's weird to think about those, you know, those peculiarities of evolution that seem so ubiquitous on Earth. We just assume they're natural categories. But I mean, who knows if a alien life form is likely to have a backbone?
Right. And I think that ultimately the segmented nature and the independence of the segments tends to imply something that is inherently invertebrate. But again, he doesn't draw a distinct line in the sand, if you will.
Well, then, to learn more about the sandworm, I think we're going to have to turn back to our old friends that we mentioned in the last episode, a couple of books that we used as resources. So one of these is going to be The Science of Dune, edited by Kevin R. Grazier. And then the other one is the Dune Encyclopedia, right?
Right. That one's compiled by Dr. Willis E. McNally. That came out in 85. It's out of print, but you can still find used copies in various places. And I got mine online for $15 or $20. So it's still out there, and it's not like an out-of-your-reach collector's item. In particular, the explanations for sandworms from these two books. From Dune Encyclopedia, we have an explanation by Maureen A. Shiflett. And in The Science of Dune, we have Sybil Hetchel, Ph.D.'s explanation from her piece, The Biology of the Sandworm. Now, I'm actually going to start with the Dune Encyclopedia explanation from Maureen Shiflett. Shiflett goes ahead and defines both male and female sandworms.
Okay.
The latter somewhat smaller than the males, with the secondary segment of each worm containing its reproductive system. And she posits that at age 1,000, because these are long-living creatures, the female develops an egg sac in her reproductive system, constructs a deep, massive nest, and then attracts a male with rhythmic thumping. Now, this is
okay.
Key because in Dune, we see people attracting or distracting a worm by using a mechanical thumper, right?
Yeah, that's one of the technologies we could have talked about in the last episode, but I guess we just didn't have time.
Mm-hmm.
The thumper is a sort of, you might think of it as a defensive decoy mechanism out in the desert where if you want to draw off a sandworm or perhaps even attract a sandworm, mm-hmm. you put this thing down in the ground and it starts beating on the sand to say, come on over.
Yeah, with a rhythmic pattern. Because if you, there's like the saying, if you got to walk without rhythm. Unless you want to attract the worm. And
right.
So, one of the things that's frequently mentioned in the book is that if you want to walk across the sand and not attract the worm, you have to walk without rhythm. You have to walk without any kind of cadence to your walk.
And I love how they bring up the fact that this is so much harder to do than it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
Like the characters are just exhausted from trying to walk without maintaining a rhythm of their gait.
Right. And so she ties this into the life cycle of the worm by saying that it's that kind of rhythmic thumping that not only indicates something unnatural on the desert surface, but perhaps the mating call of the female worm. So she says that then the male would arrive, consumes the smaller female, just straight
what?
Up eats the female, and then goes into a dormant state. And it's during this state that the heavy-duty spice fiber egg sac remains intact and is fertilized by the male's reproductive system. And then when he wakes up, he's going to spit that fertilized egg sac out.
What?
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard of reproductive cannibalism, but what?
Yeah, it's an interesting, and again, this is, her taking Herbert's world and extrapolating on it and trying to come up with a scientific explanation for how it might work.
Right.
This is not canon by any means, but it is interesting because we don't see sexual cannibalism occur in nature that I can think of where the male eats the female, because generally the female is the species. And she may or may not eat the male after he's served his purpose.
Yeah.
But here we have the male consuming the female.
Okay. I mean, that just makes me wonder if this almost would start to play with the definitions of what counts as male and what counts as female in a species.
Yeah, I feel like I would feel more comfortable with this example if the genders were reversed and primarily the sandworms are female. But either way. The best example that comes to mind of something close to this in the natural world would be anglerfish, where you have
those great things. So you've probably seen pictures of these from the deep ocean. They look like movie monsters. They've got the crazy faces, and they've got a little lit up fishing pole, right?
Yeah, and those are the females. The females are the ones we see pictures of. The males are essentially a tiny heat seeking sexual missile, equipped with gigantic nostrils. All they do is they swim out in search of a female. And if he's lucky, and most are not, they find one and they bite onto her abdomen and hang on. Again, these are the anglerfish, real world organisms, nothing from sci-fi.
And then I'm looking. I just googled. Sorry, I just googled pictures of the male anglerfish attaching to the female anglerfish, and it's pathetic.
You could go with that interpretation, because what happens is not only does he bite on and hold on, but their flesh grows together. Their blood vessels connect, and the male becomes a mere part of the female's body, sustained by her systems. His eyes, fins, and some internal organs all atrophy. And just leave him as just this fat flap of skin, this just mindless thing on the female. And this way, the male and his reproductive systems are always there when she needs them, which is a necessary adaptation in the dark, lonely world of the deep ocean.
That's fascinating. I've never read about this before.
I ran across it in the past year or two and was pretty amazed by it. But that's certainly it's a case where the male and female fuse into one. And I guess you could interpret this consumption of the female sandworm is more of a merging than a consumption, since there's not, according to her model anyway, there's not really any nourishment to be gained from the worm eating the other worm.
Okay.
So this is where we start getting into a more complex life cycle. So bear with me, everyone. The male sandworm comes to, vomits up that egg case, and he takes off. The egg case eventually hatches into a legion of sand trout.
Sand trout.
Sand trout, yes. And now these this is where we're getting back into the actual canon of Frank Herbert's sandworm biology, because these are very much a part of the series.
Yeah, there are sequences in Dune where at least one character I can think of, the planetary scientist Kynes. Mm-hmm. There may be other characters, but not that I recall. At least Kynes thinks about down under the dunes of sand, there are these massive patches of life, and there's moisture down there too, which is sort of hidden from the surface, which is, I guess, being trapped or used by these unicellular life forms.
Yeah, and in this case, we're talking 20 by 6 centimeter unicellular organisms.
What? That's a big cell.
Yeah. You know, alien world, different laws, right?
Yeah.
They're water scavengers. So the idea here is that they're traveling out, they're collecting water, they're bringing them back, according to this model anyway, to the nest site, and they're sequestering the water. And here the water mixes with excretions from the pre-spice mass, and here the CO2 builds up as a byproduct, and this eventually results in a spice blow explosion. And this is very much a part of the books, where eventually the pressure builds up and it blasts that precious spice melange that's produced somehow by this sand trout nesting water sequestering action. Blows it up to the surface where people can say, hey, there's some spice there. Let's go get it.
All right.
All right. But it's not only people that want to come get the spice. It also attracts the sandworms, which we'll get into. And at this point, according to Shiflett, the sandworms enter a pre-metamorphic stage during which surviving sand trout join bodies. And as metamorphosis sets in properly, each sand trout, also known as a little maker among the Fremen, becomes a segment of a conjoined body that becomes a small sandworm. So again, we see conjoined bodies coming into play. And this is certainly part of Herbert's original model for the sandworm.
So this is fascinating, because the sandworm in that sense is sort of a composite organism.
Yes, very much so. And this play, I don't want to give any spoilers, but this also plays out in rather unique and mind-blowing ways in the sequels.
Okay, so how long does it take for little sand trout joining together to become the gigantic Shai-Hulud like we see in the book, you know, before they're a big sandworm out in the desert?
Oh, over 1,000 years. Because it's going to take that long, according to Shiflett here, to segment for the segments to take on, the different properties such as the toothed head, the reproductive system, if you're going by her model. And during this time, if environmental conditions are not met, then the undifferentiated segments can revert to sand trout.
Oh, so that's kind of like those jellyfish that can reverse age, right?
Yeah,
they
can
revert to the earlier life form stage if things aren't going well.
Yeah, I like that detail that she throws in. And finally, the asexual juvenile worm develops, and it's 20 to 30 meters long. And this is the form that Fremen eventually capture and drown to produce spice essence.
More about spice in this episode later.
Yeah, that's coming up. Most juveniles, according to Shiflett, would become females, but it's possible that the environmental absence of a male is what results in male development. In the book itself, we're told that each male has a 300 to 400 kilometer territory that it defends against other worms.
Mm.
And she has a really interesting bit about how that combat would work.
Yeah, how do the worms fight each other if they're just – they're huge worms with big circular mouths?
Well, she draws on a detail that we'll discuss in a minute. Or I guess let's go ahead and hit it. How does someone ride a sandworm?
Ah, yes. Well, this is something we learn about later in the book, and it's very interesting. So the sandworms, like we mentioned, have these segments on their bodies. They have sort of scales that protect their soft, fleshy inner tissues from the, you know, the harsh exterior realities of Arrakis and all the sand. So a Fremen who is hopped up on spice and ready to ride will go out into the desert with some hooks and attract a sandworm using a thumper. And if the sandworm comes by at the right time, the Fremen rider can get the hooks under one of the sandworm's outer plates or these scales, segments, whatever you want to call
them. Yeah, like the edge of the segments.
Yeah. And then pull it back. And what that does is expose the sandworm's inner tissues to the external elements. Obviously, the sandworm does not like this and says, oh, no. And it rolls over to protect the exposed part of its body from the sand and in doing so can lift the rider up onto its back. And then once you're going like that, the sandworm doesn't resubmerge into the ground while it's got a part of its body exposed like that because it doesn't want sand to get in there and hurt it. So you can essentially ride this sandworm around as long as you want until it's just exhausted and collapses as long as you've got the hooks pulling back the plate.
Right.
Did I describe that about right?
Yeah. That's perfect. And so in Shiflet trying to understand like what its teeth are for, she draws on this detail and says, well, what happens when two males are getting into combat over territory, they're using those teeth to pull back each other's segments, essentially wrestling that way. And because, again, sand gets in there, it's going to irritate the flesh. And she posits that in extreme cases, this could result in a viral infection that could kill a worm. But generally, the loser breaks away. So just grappling with each other, exposing each other's inner flesh by pulling back with the teeth and eventually forcing one of them to give up and break.
Yeah, and a lot – it's like in Nature on Earth, a lot of territorial disputes between, you know, angry males of species. They don't always end in death. They just – one of them's like, okay, I give up.
Yeah, if you can have it, you can eat all the females in this region that you want. finally, a word on diet from Shiflet. Her theory here is that the sandworm is a true autotroph. That's an organism that's able to form nutritional organic substances from simple inorganic substances such as carbon dioxide. In this case, the sandworm is producing all of its nutritional needs from inorganic compounds on the planet's surface. The energy for this, she says that it drives the synthetic reactions to completion just by traveling across the sand, which causes an electrostatic charge differential, which we do see in the books with the whole, you know, you see that you already mentioned the static charge that tells you that a worm is approaching.
Yeah.
And incidentally, she also uses this as an explanation for why water would be fatal to a sandworm in that it would cause the electrons to discharge abnormally.
Yeah, now obviously it can't be that any mass of water is fatal to a sandworm because there is some tiny amount of water on Arrakis, but it sounds like a large amount of water will kill a sandworm.
Right, and it gets into that whole segmented thing because it's mentioned in the book that to really kill a sandworm, like to straight up kill it, it's so big, and since it doesn't have a central nervous system, since each segment has its own nervous system, you would have to just nuke the whole thing with one of your handy house atomics that you're not allowed to use anyway.
Wow.
Yeah.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was booted!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you ride the books, Gene. Vlastar on the business. I understand now. It's a wise man who marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Gene. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano!
Gene, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return. Your time won't. And we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, we have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Snakes, zombies, sharks, heights, speaking in public. The list of fears is endless. But while you're clutching your blanket in the dark, wondering if that sound in the hall was actually a footstep, the real danger is in your hand, when you're behind the wheel. And while you might think a great white shark is scary, what's really terrifying and even deadly is distracted driving. Eyes forward, don't drive distracted. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
So, yeah, it's kind of a complex life cycle. It's summed up in this brief bit from the appendix to Dune. Now they had a circular relationship. Little Maker, again, that's our sound trout, to pre-spice mass. Little Maker to Shahalud. Shahalud to scatter the spice upon which fed microscopic creatures called sand plankton, which we'll get into. The sand plankton, food for Shahalud, growing, burrowing, becoming Little Makers. Now, that, of course, is a little complicated, and we'll get into that, because here it seems like it sounds like one part of its own life cycle is also part of its diet.
Yeah. Yeah. That's bizarre.
All right. And this brings us to biologist Sybil Hetchel, PhD's, Science of Dune explanation, which, is also really interesting, and I think gives us our best comparison to real world biology.
Okay.
So, first of all, she zooms in on the whole idea that sand trout produce oxygen deep underground, as mentioned by Kynes in the novel. But they need an energy source to produce oxygen. And since photosynthesis is out of the question,
because they're underground.
Right. The best candidate is, of course, deep hydrothermal vents. That's how we see it working on Earth, right?
Okay.
Okay. So one could interpret the sand trout as the producer of melange. And that's, and certainly Herbert doesn't really say exactly, like, it's just right. Sandworms are key to the production of spice melange, but don't know exactly how it goes about happening.
But of course, we don't want them to go extinct.
Right. So Hetchel posits that just as sand trout scavenge and herd water, they may also tend a melange producing fungus.
Ah, so in this case, then it's not actually any part of the sandworm's life cycle that produces the spice, but they are harvesters of spice.
Right. She's theorizing that they would sequester stashes of water around these hydrothermal areas, and this would cause the spice fungus to grow. And in our world, plants, bacteria, and fungi produce the majority of exotic compounds, such as psychedelic compounds. So this would make extra sense, right? The secondary compound that's synthesized for protection by a particular fungus.
And, of course, there are examples of animals on Earth that actually do practice farming. I mean, animals other than humans.
Right. The example here would be, of course, leafcutter ants. And that's the comparison that Sybil Hetchel makes in this piece. The leafcutter ants are, of course, a number of species that are found in the Americas. And they cut tree leaves, they drag them to an underground growth chamber, and they keep it moist to cultivate fungi on the leaves. And then they – so basically it breaks down like this. They bring leaf cuttings back to the colony along well-worn forest roads and paths. We've probably all seen video or images of this. You know, very, very visual. They filter out the bad cuttings. They hand the good ones off to their farmer ants. Then they munch the leaf cuttings down into a fine mulch. Then they grow the delicious fungi on that mulch, lay some eggs in it, and enjoy. They drag the depleted leaf cuttings to the dump chamber along with all the dead ants and dead fungus. So the crazy part about this, and ultimately kind of sci-fi sounding thing about the leafcutter ants, is that they gave up hunting and gathering 50 million years ago, and they became farmers. And
they discovered the technology of agriculture before we did.
They did. And
well, not only before we did, before we existed.
Right. They not only did they find this substance, but they essentially domesticated it.
Uh-huh.
And it's grown extinct in the wild. Like, it's no longer something that they can go out and get.
So the analogy here would be, imagine if leafcutter ants could grow to become giant leafcutter ants that can eat a city. But also if the fungus that the little leafcutter ants grew in their colonies created a drug that lets you see the future.
Yeah. Yeah, imagine all those leafcutter ants Voltroning up into a larger organism over the course of a thousand years.
Uh-huh.
And I do also want to know that it's also kind of like a caveman movie in that when a winged male prepares to leave a leafcutter ant colony to found a new colony, they have to take a sample of that precious fungi with them. Because, again, it doesn't exist in the wild anymore.
Wow.
I'm just continually fascinated by that.
We're completely at the mercy of the ants if we want this fungus.
Exactly. And, of course, we don't want it, but they require it completely. It's key to their life. But back to the sandworms, okay? So we don't know exactly what sand plankton and sand trout are supposed to eat, but maybe they eat spice. But it wouldn't make sense, Hetchel argues, for the creature to both create and consume spice. So the fungus, again, makes more sense from that analogy as well, from that comparison as well. So
I wonder, you could look at, depending on what you mean by create, you could look at an example like honey in a bee colony. Now, the bees don't create the honey, but they process the honey.
Yes. And I think that would be an apt analogy here for the melange as well, that the melange is a created element. So she argues that sand trout communities, are essentially like a combination of leaf cutting ant nest and hydrothermal vent community. And in this case, sand plankton and sand trout would subsist on living spice fungi and bacterial mats that grow around the vents. She also presents the notion that sand trout are essentially asexual, and they might subsist as clone communities for quite some time, at least until the buildup of carbon dioxide from their farming efforts triggers sexual reproduction and also triggers that spice blow that results from the buildup. And then that would scatter the newly produced sand plankton. So then the sandworm comes in, it wants to eat up that spice, and in doing so, it disperses the offspring across vast distances because, of course, sandworms have those large spread out territories.
That makes sense with some earth life too. You can think about seeds that spread by growing in fruits that predators want to come and eat, or maybe not predators you'd call them. I guess they're predators of the plant. Mm-hmm. They come and want to eat the fruit, and then they take the seeds with them wherever they go afterwards.
Yeah. So now she also goes on in this piece. She has some thoughts on size constraints of enormous organisms.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to read about that, do check out the book. Do check out her piece. But we're not going to go into them in this podcast.
So one of the things I've already mentioned that I really loved about Dune is that it's the most ecologically conscious novel I've ever read. It's a novel that really has interesting thoughts about ecosystems and about resources in ecosystems, like how resources get used and conserved, specifically water and spice, and then also about how organisms feed into one another and create ecosystems. There's actually a section in the book where the planetary scientist and ecologist Kynes has visions of his father, who is also an ecologist and lived among the Fremen on the Dune planet. And the vision of his father says a couple of interesting things. He says, The more life there is within a system, the more niches there are for life. Life improves the capacity of the environment to sustain life. Life makes needed nutrients more readily available. It binds more energy into the system through the tremendous chemical interplay from organism to organism. And I think that makes a lot of sense, because whenever you imagine a rich, thriving ecosystem on Earth, it's one that already has a lot of life forms succeeding in it. It's kind of counterintuitive from a resource competition or evolutionary perspective. Places that have a lot of competition seem like they should be harder to survive in, but life creates ways for other life to thrive. And this is sort of part of the problem with Arrakis as it's imagined, unless you imagine it terraformed and seeded with other life forms, as some characters in the novel do kind of imagine. I think primarily they talk about, well, let's plant some grasses and, you know, and settle the dunes. It doesn't seem to have enough biodiversity to be very hospitable to life forms. And in addition to the sandworms, like what life forms are described as inhabiting Arrakis, Herbert mentions some scavenging birds and a few other carrion eaters and some kind of scrubby plants.
Yeah.
But I got the sense – I don't know what you thought about this. I get the sense that a lot of these animals that are described as inhabiting Arrakis are imports from human settlement. I don't know what you thought about that.
That's the sense I got as well, that like the scavenging birds have certainly evolved over over time to thrive on Arrakis. Like they're you know, they're far more conscious. They can basically hear water, you know, miles away. Uh-huh. But that they're essentially a terrestrial product.
Yeah.
While the sandworm is entirely alien.
So I don't know. Maybe somewhere if it's in the sequels or if I missed it in the book, Herbert does talk about other life forms native to Arrakis, but I can't think of any examples where I remember him talking about that. And I wanted to ask the question, if we imagine that the sandworm at the various stages of his life cycle were the one and only organism native to a planet, is something like that possible in reality? Can you have a one organism ecosystem?
Yeah, even if it's a really complex organism like this one.
I was trying to find examples of this. I found one. Actually, I think you found it first. But in 2008, there were reports that the first known single organism ecosystem had been discovered, and this was miles under the Earth in the I apologize if I'm pronouncing this wrong, Mponeng gold mine in South Africa. And it was a bacteria called Desulfurudis audaxviator. It was a rod-shaped bacterium, and it makes its living in a very remarkable way. It doesn't need sunlight, and it doesn't need any prey organisms. So it lives down there by itself, and instead it puts together the organic molecules it needs by access only to water, carbon, and nitrogen in the ground, using energy from, according to this Lawrence Berkeley lab source I read on this, hydrogen and sulfate produced by the radioactive decay of uranium. So this is it's surviving on chemicals created by radiation in the ground, almost 2 miles under the ground. This is essentially about as close to an alien microbe as I've ever heard of on Earth.
Yeah, it's pretty far removed from our, you know, traditional ecosystem model.
Yeah, and so I just thought that was fascinating. But another way of thinking about it is if you imagine way, way back in time to, I don't know, situations of abiogenesis on Earth, mm-hmm. You probably at least have to imagine that there are some periods in the history of life where there was only one organism. And then of course we got a branching ecosystem. So that again makes me wonder if you could naturally have a planet where there's really only one type of organism there. It seems like the natural course of biological evolution is to diversify.
Yeah.
But another way of thinking about this that occurred to me is that what if it is the case that the sandworm in its various stages of life is the only major organism alive on Arrakis, and it wasn't always that way? And so it could have been a planet rich with life that has essentially been conquered by a single invasive species. One organism that destroys all ecodiversity on the planet.
I could say, okay, I could see that being the case too, yeah, where you end up with just a sandworm-only ecosystem because it's that dominant a species in this environment.
Yeah. I mean, one wonders how sustainable a system like that would be. But and then, of course, if you want to think about other parallels to the sandworm in reality, you've, of course, got the Mongolian death worm.
Ah, now, the Mongolian death worm is not real, though, right?
Maybe not to you.
Well, I didn't know if maybe I'd missed a new study where they, occasionally you see an expedition to find it.
No, as far as I'm aware, no one has ever discovered the Mongolian death worm. But if you're not familiar, you should – I bet you've written a blog post about that.
I don't know if I've ever really covered Mongolian death worm. Now, I have run across – you have something called a sandworm that lives in, you know, beach sand. But, of course, that's an entirely different scenario.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. Okay, Robert.
Yes.
Imagine yourself at a party with some hip young people.
Okay.
Who start passing around the hottest new designer drug. It is the spice melange. And Herbert never is exactly clear what the spice in the book looks like, but I'm going to try to imagine it here based on a scene from the movie and a description quote I read from a sequel. It's a little glass box.
Mm-hmm.
And then inside the box, there is some orange mass. It almost looks like a like an evacuated insect shell, you know, how mm-hmm. like when the cicadas leave their shells behind after they molt. It's some stuff like that. It's kind of brownish orange. And then you press down a little piston to crush some of this stuff in the glass, and an orange liquid strains out. And it smells like cinnamon. And you can drink it right up, or you can add it to food or beverages, or have it transformed into a gas if you're a guild navigator in a tank. But it's going to be doing some weird stuff to you.
Yeah, and if you're an Arrakan denizen, if Arrakis is your home and you're not privy to a lot of outsider food coming in from other worlds, it's just going to find its way into your diet. It's just an ambient part of water and food on the world.
Yeah, and if you're not careful and you keep taking too much spice, you may begin to see the future and become fatally addicted.
Yeah, and your eyes will turn blue.
Despite the fatal addiction, there's something kind of appealing about the way they describe some of the spice consumption in the novel.
Yeah, they mention having a cup of spice coffee. I think there's some spice cakes that are mentioned here and there.
Yeah.
You're like, yeah, I would kind of like that. A nice consciousness expanding cup of coffee, as opposed to this, you know, these Red Bull and Samuda cocktails that I keep guzzling.
So, characteristics of the spice in the book, which vary according to the person taking it and the intake level, would be some of the following. First, I should say, at its core, the spice is described, I think, as an awareness drug, mm-hmm. in that it changes perception and consciousness. Now, the first major feature described is that it's the geriatric spice. It's when taken in small quantities over long periods of time, it extends your lifespan.
And that's something we probably should have mentioned more earlier on. Like, that's another reason that Arrakis is the center of the universe, because not only does the spice enable interstellar travel, it also allows the wealthy people to extend their lives.
Right. Once you're a feudal lord and you've conquered all your enemies and you've secured a place in the power structures of the universe, what's the next thing you need? You got to live forever.
Right.
So it does that. And then another effect of it is that it stains your eyes. Taking spice will cause blue tinting of the eyes, not just the irises, but the whole eye.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mind expander. It grants heightened awareness. In some cases, it allows prescience or limited omniscience. I don't know if limited omniscience is a phrase that makes any sense. It allows you to have some knowledge beyond your physical time and place, and the ability to see some aspects of the future or aspects of the present removed by distance, or to share communal awareness, sort of collaborating across aspects of mind with others.
They often make geographic comparisons in the book. So it's like looking into the future is kind of like looking across a landscape. And depending on your circumstances, you might be kind of standing in a shallow basin and you can't actually see that far. Other times it's flat. Other times maybe you're on a hill, and it depends on your prescient abilities. How far can you see?
Yeah, and then of course the negative, the downside I alluded to earlier is the addiction. When you take it in large quantities, you will get addicted to it, and if you stop taking it, you will die.
Ah, well, that'll happen.
Yeah, unfortunately. So the idea of a drug that expands consciousness is certainly something you find in many cultures, right, including our own. Mm-hmm. You know, lots of people believe things like hallucinogens like LSD, marijuana, psilocybin mushrooms, and the ayahuasca brew, which I think the active chemical in that is DMT, right?
Right.
Yeah. And so under various circumstances, people have suggested all these drugs not only provide euphoria and sometimes sensory hallucinations, but that they actually provide access to information or knowledge about reality that is not otherwise available to people. One of the most common claims you hear is the sort of transcendence journey, you might call it, where the hallucinogen gives the user a mental vantage point from which he or she claims to see a deeper reality or to now understand that our day-to-day experiences are not all there is. I'm sure you've encountered this before.
Oh, yeah. And of course, that's key to most religions, too, that you have at the heart, there's a deeper understanding of reality that you have to uncover.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting. I think the hallucinogen comparison to spice is perhaps quite on point because in a 2005 book called Mycelium Running by the American mycologist Paul Stamets, that's a person who studies fungus, mm-hmm. The author claims that Frank Herbert – well, I should just read this quote. It says he says that Frank Herbert was apparently an enthusiastic mushroom collector himself who came up with this great – system for growing chanterelle mushrooms in a way that people hadn't realized how to do before by creating this spore slurry in a bucket. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he says of Frank Herbert, Frank went on to tell me that much of the premise of Dune, the magic spice spores that allowed the bending of space, tripping, the giant worms, maggots digesting mushrooms, the eyes of the Fremen, the cerulean blue of psilocybin mushrooms, the mysticism of the female spiritual warriors, the Bene Gesserits, influenced by tales of Maria Sabina and the sacred mushroom cults of Mexico, came from his perception of the fungal life cycle, and his imagination was stimulated through his experiences with the use of magic mushrooms.
All right. Well, that certainly matches up with what we see in the book. And again, bearing in mind that this is, rising out of 1965, the mid-60s, and a lot of the counterculture movements that were taking place there and the role of drugs and hallucinogens in that subculture.
Yeah, certainly. Though one thing about that was weird, I Googled the psilocybin mushrooms and they didn't look blue to me. I don't know.
Yeah, images.
Maybe they're sometimes
that
blue.
I have seen have not. Yeah, they look like mushrooms to me. I've never noticed a blue one.
Anyway, to go back to the science of Dune, the writer Carol Hart, PhD, has a great essay about the spice melange in the science of Dune. And she makes some really interesting points comparing spice to hallucinogens like the ones I mentioned above, LSD, psilocybin mushrooms, ayahuasca. And there are the following changes that you can notice that are similar. One would be changes to the eyes. The spice, it seems, causes a more permanent kind of change with the blue tint. Mm-hmm. But hallucinogens like LSD and ayahuasca typically cause an extreme dilation of the pupils.
Okay.
She also notices suspension of time, right? Mm-hmm. An ecstatic and sometimes frightening sense of communion with others. Out-of-body sensations, loss of self and merger into a oneness, euphoria, death-rebirth experience, visions/hallucinations, and prescience and life-changing realizations. And I think this is one of the most interesting things because, like I said earlier, a lot of times people take hallucinogens not just with the idea that I'm going to see something interesting, but they take it with the idea that they're learning something about the true nature of reality. They're getting access to facts and useful information. She says, for example, for the Amazonian shamans, ayahuasca allowed the soul to leave the body, to search out the explanation for illness in the individual or problems threatening the community, and to decide the course of action.
Yeah, I remember reading some words from Buddhist Alan Watts, who was also part of, you know, the certainly a name during the 60s and 70s, and he was commenting on the use of psychedelic drugs in the counterculture, and he compared them to the use of a telescope or a microscope.
Huh.
That it's something that you you put your eye to the telescope or the microscope to learn something about reality, but then you also have to re-engage with reality. You have to put the telescope or the microscope down in order to take those lessons and apply them to life.
Yeah. Another really interesting parallel with Dune, I think, is that the effect of the drug, whether you're talking about real hallucinogens or the spice in Dune, is not just a product of the drug. It's not just here are the molecules in the drug and what they'll do to you, but they're a product, a sort of combinatorial product of the drug acting on body and the preparation that the user has experienced.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about preparation. It's about departure state. Some people will take LSD, and just mess around and have some weird experiences and don't learn a whole lot from it. Some people might have bad trips. Some people might have what they would consider to be transcendent experiences. And I think there are a lot of people who throughout the years have been advocates of controlled hallucinogen use who lament the fact that it's taken for kicks.
Yeah, I mean, we look at some of the current research, and we're finally seeing a lot more research into psychedelics these days. For a while, it was such a taboo area, you know, really kind of poisoned by the more extreme aspects of the counterculture and the way that it gained coverage in the media. We're finally seeing it being an area that can get funded and be studied. And there have been some really fascinating looks into how the right levels of hallucinogens combined with appropriate priming, preparation for the experience, and as well as sort of after exploration of what they felt. It can be used to help terminally ill patients as they prepare to die. It can be used in various therapies, even addiction therapies. The priming, the purpose, really the ritual of it is essential. I mean, I imagine a number of our listeners can think of some individual they've come across before that, at least on the surface, looks like they are gaining nothing of value from their experimentation with psychedelics. And then on the other hand, there are cases where, this particular thinker claims to have had some sort of profound insight intellectually or creatively while trying one of these substances.
Yeah. So as Albert Hofmann, the discoverer of LSD, once wrote, he said, special internal and external advanced preparations are required. With them, an LSD experiment can become a meaningful experience. So I think he was one of those people who recommended the preparations that go into making yourself ready for the mental journey of expanded consciousness.
Yeah.
If you don't put the preparation time in, it doesn't work. And we see this in the novel Dune because people consuming lots of spice react to it in very different ways. You get the sense that when Paul Atreides starts taking lots of spice and then has his moment of expanded consciousness, begins to see the future, begins to have heightened awareness and prescience and limited omniscience, it's all because of the things that have gone into making Paul who he is. It's not just like he got a really strong hit of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the fact that he's been trained in the Bene Gesserit ways that we talked about in the last episode, in the Mentat ways. All this that went into making him who he is also made the expanded consciousness what it was. You can see that in contrast to another character in the novel, the Twisted Mentat. Do you call him Piter or Peter?
I always read it as Peter, but Piter might be more accurate.
They call him Piter in the David Lynch movie. Okay. I'll call him Peter. Peter DeVries, the bad Mentat who works for the evil Harkonnens. They say he takes huge amounts of spice too. He just gobbles it like candy. Can't get enough of it. But he does not seem to have this same type of expanded awareness that Paul has from extended spice use. And it seems to be that it's because of different types of preparation going into the experience.
Yeah, I mean, the other example, of course, the guild navigators who have been engineered and bred to pilot these spaceships while using the spice. So they consume the spice in order to safely navigate folded space. And as celestial mechanic John C. Smith points out in The Science of Dune, There's a quantum physics tie-in here. So 8 years before the publication of Dune, physicist Hugh Everett III proposed a radical interpretation of quantum mechanics, that everything that can happen does happen, and each possible action spawns a new universe.
This is what's known as the mini-worlds theory. Every time there's an indeterminate quantum event, the universe branches off into separate realities.
It's the very thing that that Borges referenced with the Library of Babel. That this library would contain not only all books, but all possible books. So taking the spice here would allow the navigator to at least see the immediate path of the ship in many different multiverses, and then safely, you know, choose the safest path. And interestingly enough, there is kind of a real world tie-in here, because according to a 1973 study compiled by the RAND Corporation for the U.S. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, there was a Soviet plan to launch psychics into orbit.
Quote, how much faith should we put in this report?
I mean, maybe a grain of salt. I'll read the quote here. Regarding precognition, we found only one unverified report by a Soviet investigator that a program was being planned to train astronauts to, quote, foresee and to avoid accidents in space. It was clear from the context that he was referring to precognitive process. So, I don't know. If they did look into it, obviously it didn't work out, but this was a time of when, you know, the stakes were high in the Cold War. So if there was a possibility that there was something to some sort of paranormal situation,
sure,
you checked it out.
Yeah, why not train a bunker full of psychics?
Yeah. The same RAND Corporation report also mentioned that there was a test into psychic communication by sacrificing a litter of baby rabbits on board a Soviet submarine.
What?
And the idea here was that the mother rabbit located on the surface might receive psychic signals from the dying young. So, this is all unverified, but but it seems possible based on some of the other reports we've heard about both the U.S. and Soviet investigations into the potential use of paranormal effects.
You know, one of the things that's interesting to me about the role of spice in the Dune universe is that it posits a world in which the entire universe is completely dependent on a resource that essentially produces effects similar to things that are taboo in our culture, that not only do we, you know, not depend on as a society, but we try to stamp out and say that's not okay.
Yeah, like essentially everyone in the book seems to be taking some sort of performance-enhancing substance. If it's not melange, then it's the then they're taking Samuto, or they're taking the I can't remember the name of it, but that wine that the Mentats drink, which I believe is supposed to be derived from the same source as Samuto.
Yeah, the purple stained lips.
Yeah, so everybody's just cranked to the gills on something because you can't depend on the thinking machine, you got to depend on the human mind.
So maybe you could say that if we had to get rid of our computers, there would be, I don't know, less opposition to recreational drug use.
Maybe so, yeah, yeah. All right, you know, we're running out of time here, and I don't know, we might even have to cut this part, but I do want to mention the Bini Thelaxu face dancers before we close out. These are characters that you did not encounter in the book because they don't show up until book two and then play an increasingly important role moving on. But as we mentioned, I think in the first episode, the Bini Thelaxu, this is a group, this is like a faction in the Dune universe that are really involved in transhuman, posthuman machinations. They're changing the human form, engineering new people to survive in this post-singularity, you know, post-Butlerian jihad world. And so they're doing things like essentially engaging in cloning, the produce of these gulas that play an important role in the later books, where a dead individual is brought back as a clone.
I like the sound of that.
Yeah, they're the faction that creates the twisted Mentats that we've already discussed, and then they also have these face dancers who are known and feared as spies and assassins. And they're essentially shapeshifters. They can change their face, their appearance, their voice, everything to resemble another person. And so they, you know, it gives them unparalleled acting ability. They serve as entertainers throughout the galaxy. And they're also key Thilaxu diplomats and conspirators, as well as just core members of their society. So there's actually a couple of cool articles about how this might work, essentially how a shape-shifting humanoid might work as an organism. The first and the primary one I want to mention comes to us from the 1984 Dune Encyclopedia. And this is from contributor Walter E. Myers. And he very much envisions face dancer biology, a shape-shifting biology, as a complex creation of training, breeding, embryonic manipulation, genetic tinkering, and surgical augmentation. So basically throwing all of these various... Everything we got at creating this shape-shifting creature. So I'm not going to go through the entire entry because it's he has a lot of details that he throws out. But here are the high points. This is what you would need. Key alterations include selected breeding for appropriate physicality and muscle control.
Okay.
Because you're going to need muscle control to shift the face around and shift everything about. Embryonic stimulation of overdeveloped back muscles and hyperelastic spine for height control.
Gross.
Yeah. The embryonic manipulation of the body's salomic sacs, altering their position and allowing them to serve in the voluntary inflation of artificial tubes that are implanted after puberty, thus allowing conscious body size alteration. So essentially bladders in the body that allow you to just fill up as needed.
Okay.
Childhood augmentation of facial structure, replacing certain facial bones with elastic cartilage, coupled with extensive training to allow total manipulation of facial features. Cellular embryonic manipulation to allow conscious control of scalp temperature. Yeah, because this would be used to allow the color manipulation of artificial liquid crystal hair follicles that are later implanted like individually.
Mm-hmm.
Genetic manipulation to enable the conscious hormonal control of eye pigment. Fetal manipulation and surgical augmentation to produce male genitals that are retractable within a vaginal cavity for visual gender swapping. So they wouldn't actually be able to change sex, but they could sort of retract the genitals into a cavity as if they were the landing gear of an airplane.
Oh, wow.
Training and surgery to enhance deferential muscle and autonomic nerve control. So in other words, a face dancer, by this definition, would be an extremely complex product and no mere human subspecies. But this is just one take. We also have a take from Sandy Field in her essay, Evolution by Any Means on Dune. And this is from The Science of Dune. And she goes into a lot of these sort of highly evolved human models that we discuss here. But she posits that face dancers mimic their targets through conscious migration of body cells. So in order to swiftly change form, a face dancer would need to reorganize its skin cells, musculature, and skeletal elements, a feat they might accomplish through the dissolution and recombination of the cell-to-cell bonds that hold the tissue together. Now, how might the Thilaxu have accomplished this? Here's what she had to say. Quote, "The concerted action of newly created hormones selected genetically by the Thilaxu over many generations could act to allow different cell types to move when prompted by neurological signals. Face dancing, then, could be a genetically derived ability to generate specific hormones at will, which allow for the concerted movement of skin, muscle, bone, and other cells to new locations to create the appearance of another person." So there you go.
I mean, I appreciate that as a great attempt to explanation. I somehow don't feel like a creature like that could exist in reality. I mean, certainly you can imagine some types of, you know, chameleon type elements like changing pigmentation. I mean, we see octopuses and stuff that have a remarkable ability to change their external appearance at will. But the moving of bones and things like that, that sounds impossible to me.
Yeah, I do love the rigor in both of these examples because one takes a very you know, genetic, cellular, hormonal approach, and the other is a very more of a varied approach, but also all into just post-human cybernetic tinkering.
Yeah,
and I guess in reality, you could create a model that is a combination of the two. Maybe draw in some biomimicry by looking to the world of the octopus or the cuttlefish. And saying, well, how could you create those same sort of flesh effects in a humanoid creature?
Well, here's something I would say. I don't know to what extent they have shape-shifting precision in the books, but I would buy this creature more if it could make basic changes to its body, but not sort of target a particular individual. Like, I can look now exactly like Robert Lamb, as opposed to just I can look different than I normally look.
Yeah. It would, and I think in the books it's laid out that it depends on how long they study a target. So if they study, they just sort of glance at you, it would be like a very rough version, but they would ideally want to study you in earnest for a few days before replacing you.
Yeah.
All right. So there you go. We're out of time. That's the biology of Dune.
But before we go, Robert, I got to ask you about the David Lynch movie.
Yes.
I've been burning to talk about this. No, I mean, I read the book and then I watched the movie, and there's so much to like about the movie, actually, because it's got great sets and costumes. Some parts of it are truly weird in ways that are really fun and exciting, and other aspects of it are just incomprehensible. I watched it with my wife, Rachel, and I constantly had to explain things because the movie does not make sense on its own.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've seen the movie, though I did last night. I rewatched the intro material that was on the TV airing of it, where they have the still illustrations and some narration to set up the world.
I
agree. There's so much that doesn't work in the films and ultimately led to it being a kind of a train wreck. But then there's so many elements that are well done. Like, some of the casting is just weird. Some of the casting is just spot on. The costumes are amazing. Some of the visual takes on the world are just perfect, but it just doesn't all come together.
Yeah. I think Dune could be a really great animated movie.
Yeah. Like, imagine if Miyazaki had taken it on, because you have the ecological elements that he's so present in his work.
Oh man, that's a thing that I think was really lacking in at least the version of Dune that I saw. Now, I heard that there's a shorter version and a longer version. I'm not sure which one I saw. If there's a shorter version, I cannot imagine it, because the version I saw left out so much explanation. It's crazy. But one thing that really seemed left out of the movie is the ecological themes of the book. All the concerns about water, about how to survive in the environment. I mean, this is a key part of the book, and it's maybe one out of every three pages is primarily about water.
Yeah,
and this is just not the case in the movie.
Yeah, indeed, and that's ultimately a large thing to be missing from the finished product.
On the other hand, the movie does have – I don't know if you remember this from the movie, but the strategically inserted pug.
Oh, yes.
House Atreides has a pug.
Yeah, and after you mentioned this, I saw the pug shows up in the still illustrations for the TV version intro.
So it's got Jürgen Prochnow standing there with his beard and his uniform holding a pug.
Yeah.
There's also a scene of Patrick Stewart as Gurney Halleck fighting a battle, and he's got the pug in his arms.
Yeah, I do not remember. In my reread of the book, I've not come across the pug yet.
I'm pretty sure they added that. Pug Atreides is not in the book.
Yeah, they added the pug. They added the weirding module. And a few other things they added, and then left out some key things as well. So there you go. Well, hey, I know that a lot of you out there have comments you would like to add on the Dune universe, on the Dune movies, on some of this, some of the possible science behind the biology, behind the technology that we discussed in the other episodes. And we would, of course, love to hear from you. As always, check out our homepage, stufftoblowyourmind.com. And you'll also want to check out the landing page for this episode that will include links out to these books that we've mentioned, to related articles, as well as where you can find some of the music that we've featured. And indeed, as we close out here, we're going to be listening to the track Arrakis by musician Raleigh Porter off his 2011 album Aftertime, released by Subtext Recordings. There'll be a link to that on the landing page for this episode, but you can also learn more about him and his work at RaleighPorter.com.
And if you want to get in touch with us about your favorite aspect of the Dune novels or the Dune movies, or your least favorite aspect, or just tell us what you think about Dune or give us feedback on the episode, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene! Gene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right. That's right.